The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Ian McEwan's works have earned him worldwide critical acclaim, starting with the Somerset Maugham Award in 1976 for his first collection of short stories, First Love, Last Rites, to the Man Booker Prize for Atonement. He is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, a Fellow of the Royal Society of Arts, and a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Claire Massoud describes his writing like this: McEwan's prose, so fluid and elegant, so vivid and meticulous, carries a narrative of great moments and insights of otherwise ineffable grandeur, and he forces his readers to turn the pages with greater dread and anticipation than does perhaps any other literary writer working in English today. This evening, he joins us with Lessons, his 18th novel. He will be joined in conversation with novelist and musician Wesley Stace. Please join me in welcoming them back to the Free Library.
Thank you very much. We thought we'd start the proceedings with a very short reading, so don't worry. The days of the 45-minute readings are over. Thank goodness. Nothing to say, therefore, by introduction, except I wanted to read to you the six words that are the epigraph at the beginning of this, and they come from Finnegan's Wake, which I know everyone here has read cover to cover. Actually, if you do pick it up, go to the last three pages. They're some of the most beautiful things that Joyce ever wrote. And in there, you will find these six words that rather resonated for me and this book. And they are this: first we feel, then we fall. And so we start with feeling. This was insomniac memory, not a dream. It was a piano lesson again, an orange tiled floor, one high window, a new upright in a bare room close to the sick bay. He was 11 years old, attempting what others might know as Bach's first prelude from book one of the Well-Tempered Clavier, simplified version. But he knew nothing of that. He didn't wonder whether it was famous or obscure. It had no when or where. He could not conceive that someone had once troubled to write it. The music was simply here, a school thing, or dark, like a pine forest in winter, exclusive to him, his private labyrinth of cold sorrow. It would never let him leave. The teacher sat close by him on the long stool, round-faced, erect, perfumed, strict. Her beauty lay concealed behind her manner. She never scowled or smiled. Some boys said she was mad, but he doubted that. He made a mistake. In the same place, the one he always made, and she leaned in closer to show him. Her arm was firm and warm against his shoulder. Her hands, her painted nails, were right above his lap. He felt a terrible tingling, draining his attention. Listen, it's an easy, rippling sound. But as she played, he heard no easy rippling. Her perfume overwhelmed his senses and deafened him. It was a rounded, cloying scent, like a hard object, a smooth river stone pushing in on his thoughts. 3 years later, he learned it was rose water. "Try again," she said it on a rising tone of warning. She was musical. He was not. He knew that her mind was elsewhere and that he bored her with his insignificance, another inky boy in a boarding school. His fingers were pressing down on the tuneless keys. He could see the bad place on the page before he reached it. It was happening before it happened. The mistake was coming towards him, arms outstretched like a mother, ready to scoop him up. Always the same mistake, coming to collect him without the promise of a kiss. And so it happened. His thumb had its own life. Together they listened to the bad notes fade into the hissing silence. "Sorry," he whispered to himself. Her displeasure came as a quick exhalation through her nostrils, a reverse sniff he had heard before. Her fingers found his inside leg just at the hem of his grey shorts and pinched him hard, and that night there would be a tiny blue bruise. Her touch was cool as her hand moved up under his shorts to where the elastic of his pants met his skin. He scrambled off the stool and stood, flushed. "Sit down, you'll start again." Her sternness wiped away what had just happened. It was gone, and he already doubted his memory of it. He hesitated before yet another of those blinding encounters with the ways of adults. They never told you what they knew. They concealed from you the boundaries of your ignorance. What happened, whatever it was, must be his fault, and disobedience was against his nature. So he sat, lifted his head to the sullen column of treble clefs where they hung on the page, and he set off again, even more unsteadily than before. There could be no rippling, not in this forest. Too soon he was nearing that same bad place. Disaster was certain, and knowing that confirmed it as his idiot thumb went down when it should have stayed still. He stopped. The lingering discord sounded like his name spoken out loud. She took his chin between knuckle and thumb and turned his face towards hers. Even her breath was scented. Without shifting her eyes from his, she reached for the 12-inch ruler from the piano lid. But he was not going to let her smack him. But as he slid from the stool, he didn't see what was coming. She caught him on his knee with the edge, not the flat, and it stung. He stood and moved back a step. "You'll do as you're told and sit down now." His leg was burning, but he wouldn't put his hand to it yet, not yet. So he took one last look at her, her beauty, her tight, high-necked, pearl-button blouse, at the fan diagonal creases in the fabric formed by her breasts below her correct and steady gaze. Thank you.
So nice to see you again.
We were last here so many years ago discussing my Talking Fetus book.
Yes, we were.
Nutshell.
That was before so many things happened in the world.
Most of them not good.
No, but this novel happened.
That's true.
When we were here last time, when I heard you talk in Brooklyn quite a few years ago, it was about atonement, and you said how the novel had started for you in a kind of an image that you had of, you know, that's kind of at the beginning of that book. And I seem to remember you saying that had happened with other books for you, that perhaps... Yeah. And I wondered, I think I have read that this novel was quite COVID-influenced in the fact that you had lockdown and there was a lot of time to write. But what was the kind of setting off an image or perhaps the initial idea with Lessons?
I had an idea for a novel, but it was more like a kind of vacant space. I knew I wanted to settle down to a very long novel and live inside it without any sense of hurry. I travelled a lot in 2019 with my wife, and this idea was beginning to take the shape around an individual life, possibly having elements of my own life in it, but that it would reflect elements of international affairs, global events that penetrated, protruded into the intimate life. But I had no characters. It was just a theoretical idea. Anyway, I said to Annalena, we've hardly spent more than a week in a row at home during 2019. And when we get home, I would really like to spend the whole year at home. So be careful what you wish for. So well before the lockdown started in November, I started doodling. So it has some connection to atonement, but I had a slightly stronger sense. And I wrote the passage that I've just read. In fact, considerably more, maybe about 3,000 words. And the prose itself dissatisfied me immensely. But immediately I felt, well, I know that room. That was one of the practice rooms at my boarding school. So there was already an opening into that place, which fitted well with my sense that I would steal bits of my own life. And immediately I thought, this is the beginning of a sexual grooming, which would culminate, but I didn't know how, where, or when, in abuse. And as soon as I thought of that, I thought of how certain events, dark events in our early life, can cast long shadows, and how coming to terms with it often means rewriting it, understanding it anew, not knowing even that it's abuse. Some, or maybe even many victims of abuse think of themselves as the agent, of having agency in it, having choices, when in fact they're too young to have choices. So I sat on this passage. The first business was to move it out of the first person, away from a rather flowing, verbless, punctuation-free, almost Virginia Woolf-like prose into something more analytical. Because I thought, if I'm going to have these global events, I need a different kind of prose, the one that gives me the complete freedom to describe the state of the world, name the world, but also then become, with all the joy and freedom of free and direct style, to zoom in closely and on a focused third-person character. So once that was revised, I had certain of the elements, at least, of what I understood now to be a whole life was ahead of me. I've always been interested in character and how character can be set down on the page, aware of the extraordinary inheritance we have from the great masters of the 19th century. And I'm thinking from Jane Austen right through Flaubert, by way of George Eliot, Tolstoy, and so on, who created amazing characters, people we still talk about, almost as if they sort of lived up the street or we read about them in newspapers. Then modernism fell in the way and somewhat challenged the notion of character. Virginia Woolf famously said, or wrote, character is dead. But we haven't been able to do without it. I mean, through the modernist aesthetic revolution, which has changed our ways of thinking fundamentally, and the postmodern, and the novels of Rob Grier, which have no characters in them, bold, hopeless experiments. We still need people in our books, largely. I mean, some people are happy with an empty chair. and I think nearly all my colleagues want someone to sit in it. We want a person. So the obvious then next thought is, if you could take a character right through a whole life, then you will have character in a way that we often live other people's character, understand other people around us. So it all began from a bit of doodling, but it was much more hedged around by certain ambitions than Atonement was. Atonement was an unwrapping. I had to start writing it to find out what it was about.
I mean, One of the first things that kind of strikes you, even when you get it, is that my experience reading the book was almost constant delight, a very moving book, in a way that and you know, in ways there were things that were familiar about it from your writing, and things that were really exciting and different about it that seemed, you know, words like, you know, it's a bit of a March of Time novel. It's a little bit Dickensian in a way you've just mentioned. It's a whole person's life. You know, it's for those of us who've known your earlier fiction, which is all of us, I'm sure. You know, there were elements about it that were surprising to me and must have been exciting for you to kind of engage with. Not that any of it felt impossible, but that this was a kind of a new adventure for you as a writer. Obviously, Atonement's a big book, but so many of your books are quite, well, they're smaller than this, they're more focused than this. And although I could see traces of almost everyone in the book, yet this felt, you know, a little bit more akin to like a William Boyd experience of a novel, or, you know, or even a, you know, a Jonathan Coe, to pick a excellent popular British novelist.
There's a certain liberation for me in deciding to put down bits of my own life, childhood, parents, lost brother who turns up, being present at the fall of the Berlin Wall, in ways that I've never approached remotely before. You can't write a novel without some bits of your life floating in, because the novel is such a personal form. I think it's the most personal of all the art forms we have available to us. You cannot say to your best friend who's just given you his or her novel, look, your novel is crap, and expect to get away with it or keep a friendship, because it is so revealing. In fact, you mentioned Atonement. Bryony finds it embarrassing to even write, he said. You know, there's something, when we know he didn't, you know, there's something revealing even about that. And yet, there is Dickens, who spread his childhood, investigated his childhood at least 7 or 8 times in his novels. And I've always thought, well, I don't have a blacking factory, so why would I do that? But still, the novels of Bello, Updike, Toni Morrison, lately Karl Ove Knausgård, have done this extraordinary thing. You can take it for granted, but you know also that it's massive artifice to create on the page the things that people recognize as part of our shared experience. So that gave me a much more expansive... That's why I knew it was going to be a long book, even before I knew the elements of it. The first thing I needed to do was aware that this is going to be a long book, aware that many long books don't earn their keep, was to make sure that all the threads that were laid down in Act One, which has 4 chapters, were kept alive in Act Two and then brought to a head in Act Three. So I had a very clear sense of my old love of architecture in the novel, but still with the freedom to investigate slowly, let things cook, and also move around in time too.
Yes, so, there's a lot of that, isn't there? Because also there are segments of the book, like there's the two different, completely distinct German segments in the book, aren't there? And so in many ways, in some ways, it's like it does have as much time travel, as it were, as Atonement, doesn't it?
One of the reasons that I chose to have chapters of about somewhere between 12 and 15,000 words long is that if you've been in 1959 and now suddenly you're in 1986, to do that in a mosaic can be, I think, not very compelling. Whereas if you've got 12,000 words suddenly in 1986, you can dwell there.
Mm.
You've dwelt in one period of time, now you can dwell in another. And as the novel proceeds, it becomes more and more sequential. There's less manoeuvring within time frames,
yeah.
Especially once you get to the third act, as it were. So, yeah, I need always that structure that I respect so much in writers like Conrad. A sure sense, and I like to feel it as a reader, that if you think of a novel as a house, that you don't want to enter it by the back door. But if you do, you need a strong and unfolding sense of what this structure is. And perhaps that devolves around the word authority. I mean, and I speak now as a reader, not a writer. Sometimes you pick up a novel and within three pages you know you're in the hands of a good authority.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that particularly with George Eliot. I mean, you just sense that there are small things happening in the first few pages that really relate to everything else, that they are, you're already reading a microcosm of the novel you're going to undertake to live with. So those things have become very important even before you know what you've got or how you're going to get to where you want to be.
Well, we come back to you mentioned the autobiography in it, and we could come back to that in a moment, given that's a fact. But one of the most delightful things about the book, or the most moving things, is the character of Roland. And I only have read one review of the novel, which I read in the taxi on the way to this thing,
right.
Because it popped up on my New York Times thing. And the woman who reviewed it made, I thought, a pretty compelling point that, and I wanted to know your response to it, that quite a few of your books reside on a kind of pivotal incident that the characters respond to either side of. Whereas what, because we can give away.
You can give it all away. So.
Well, I don't. If anyone's going to give it away, you should give it away. But the point, not to give too much away, but this abuse is then Roland Baines, the main character, can't work out how much this is to kind of blame for who he is now and what effect it's had on him and what effect it's had on the other event of the first chapter, basically, which is that his wife in the more present day has walked out and left the house keys on the pillow. And I thought it was a pretty compelling point in the review, that what makes it quite different from many of your books is that I didn't quite agree with her because I feel that it's pretty clear what has messed him up in a way, but that it's in a way you are interrogating that method of pivotal incident and change, and that he is never quite allowed that certainty, he being a very sympathetic character and a character full of forgiveness and beautiful human traits, which you see a muddled person getting older and dealing with his life and ending up an old man with his granddaughters, you know. Yeah. So well, I just wanted to know what you thought about that.
I mean, I knew that when I called this novel Lessons, people would bound to ask me, well, what are the lessons? And actually, it's very hard as you get older to draw any conclusions about lessons in life except total mind-numbing banalities like, you know, love is good and kindness is crucial and make your own path or don't make your own path. So there is no... this novel is partly about how many of life's problems are never solved. How most things are either forgotten, suppressed, or they simply become part of the load, the baggage, part of what you're carrying with you through life. And one of the most dreadful words in the English language, I think, is closure. It's a ridiculous concept. Should we all become lotus eaters about what's happened to us? No. So there is never, there aren't any conclusions. Novels and movies like to project for formal reasons that certain things do get solved. And lots of 19th century short stories especially were tied to the notion you'd get last sentences like, it was my uncle all the time. Or, you know, but in life you don't discover it was your uncle all the time. You're often baffled, all the questions remain. Just as you will die, and there will still be in the top drawer of your chest of drawers unmatched socks. You will never have got round to getting either finding the others or getting rid of the ones that irritate you and have done for the last 30 years. So Roland runs away from a love affair that lasts for 2 years between the ages of 14 and 16. He's not ruined, but his life is massively deflected. For the next 10 years, he simply manages to suppress all memories of that. Then he begins to be aware that his sexual restlessness and wishing to recreate this extraordinary experience can never happen. So he becomes marriage shy, relationship shy. He bores women with his relentlessness of wanting. He's never unfaithful. He's relentlessly monogamous, always pursuing some extraordinary spiritual, sexual, emotional, intellectual union up there in the clouds. And of course, you know, people have to go to do jobs and but he knows that that's the demon at his back. And it moves on too. I'm not going to go through the whole process of that. But Roland does finally marry a German woman. They have a baby whom they both love deeply. They live in a squalid two up, two down house in South London. And one day she simply vanishes, but she leaves a sort of loving note on the pillow, which she says she loves him, but she cannot live this life. And it takes him a long time to discover that she's left him in order to become a novelist. And she will go on to become Europe's greatest novelist. When the wall comes down, I mean, excuse these spoilers, because in 1989, he's there from the second day. He runs into her, as he half expects he will. They have a rather bitter confrontation. He's still very angry, dismayed, sorry that she's gone. She hands him a book. When he gets to his hotel back on the west side, he's dismayed after reading several pages to discover that it's brilliant. And he's caught in a kind of ambivalence. He wants to be angry with her, but he reads the first 180 pages, the next 5 hours, puts the book down and thinks it's a masterpiece. Where does that leave him? He absolutely understands that she would never have written this with a sleepless baby, piles of laundry, the general kinds of chaos and sense of the world closing in on you that everyone has with a first baby. I always say to people when they've got a baby and they've got that kind of hunted look of someone who hasn't slept, that it's always the first 55 years that are the hardest. So she's left him in the way that many men have left and gets... and I'm very conscious to explore the idea that you cannot say the name Doris Lessing without someone saying, oh, she left her children behind. Whereas the literary biographies are stuffed with men who ran off, leaving wife and children for the sole purpose of their art, plus, of course, a younger woman. So that's a parallel concern, again, which can never be resolved for Roland, that he's been left, but he's been left for the cause of actually an extraordinary art.
And does that, I only just thought of this, but does that, you know, the woman leaving the man for art in some way parallel the boy being groomed by a woman for abuse, or however you want to phrase that? It only occurred to me when you, but it struck me as a rather McEwan-y thing to have being the centre of the book, because it's something that one could have pictured in one of your early short stories, for example, where people would have been, you know, horribly shocked by that. But in fact, what you're doing is just flipping it the other way up.
I mean, I looked into this a bit, sort of something like 97% of sexual abuse cases are male on female, but it happens, and I'm not writing sociology here. I'm writing fiction, plus which it might sound really surprising to some people, but there are similarities between men and women as well as differences. They have some humanity in common, and anyone who's a victim of sexual abuse suffers in ways that I think are kind of universal. And the bafflement and working it out, I think, is... Yeah. If I was going to follow someone over such a length of time, I wanted to inhabit the victim. I feel that I could do that best as a man looking into another man. I've written plenty of women characters, and I have no patience with this sort of appropriation stuff, but it's the business of novelists, of course, to imagine. But in this case, I really wanted to be not appropriating the experience of a woman and living inside a man. And since heterosexual sex is the sex I know best or better, I wanted to live in that too. So that was, it was never mischief about this. It was almost a sort of given. So... people kept telling me when I'd finish, oh, you're going to get a lot of trouble about that. But it hasn't happened.
Right, that's interesting. If you think about Roland Baynes, Baynes is quite a kind of a doleful name in its... It has a kind of a doleful sound to it.
It's a Scots name.
There you go.
Yeah. All fog and mist.
Well, how about Roland, though? It's quite knightly.
Yeah, it's the Old Alliance. It's a French name. Somewhere there's just one sentence that lets you know that when Roland's father was in the retreat to Dunkirk beaches, he was sheltered with his wounds by a farmer called Roland. That's all there is to it. In other words, I was trying to make the point, there's no significance to this. It's not about the Chanson de Roland. it's no a reference to Roland Barthes. it's hard work to make a novel about which someone will not ascribe meaning to the names. I once received a PhD from... actually a college in the maybe Louisiana, not Louisiana, Denmark, which I know is what you're thinking, but Louisiana, USA. And the PhD was all about my names and how they all referred to characters in the Old Testament. And actually, I went to give a reading in New York City a couple of days ago. Standing outside was a guy with a Bible. And he said, I ask writers to sign my Bible. So what passage would you like to sign? I said, well, give me Corinthians, because I think it's one of the splendid secular stretches of the Bible. And he said, well, I'm an atheist. He said, I don't know my way. I assumed he was a Bible-loving guy.
Just an autograph.
But I said, I could find Corinthians for you quite easily, but I suddenly lost patience.
As Roland lives his life, he is looking back on his memories, and partly because of the thing that you've just mentioned about the victim thinking they're somehow complicit, but he's questioning his memories all the time. Since there is an autobiographical element to this book in a way that you said was an interesting new thing to write about, were you doing that too? And were you analysing things for truth from your own life as you did them?
In some ways, I was making certain discoveries of things, not completely for the first time, but consolidating ideas. In my life, in my family, my mother had two children, and in 1940, her husband was sent off, joined the infantry in the call-up, and went off to fight in the desert wars of North Africa. She then had an affair while her husband was away with the man who, some years later, would be my father. To their astonishment, shock, or total expectation, she conceived a child. It was born in November 1940, and they had to give it away. There'd be unbelievable hatred and scandal in the village from her point of view, because everybody knew that her husband was fighting at the front for Montgomery in the desert against Rommel. And from my father's point of view, it would mean disgrace. I mean, to have an affair with the wife of a serving soldier. So they put an advert in the local paper which said, home wanted for baby boy, 6 weeks old, complete surrender. And so my mother got on the train with her sister, my aunt, and they went to the town of Reading, which is like 30 miles outside London, and handed the baby over to a couple who had replied to their advert. Now, in the writing of this, I remembered that in a box somewhere in my study was an envelope full of old photographs, and in there I found one of my mother, taken in a studio, black and white, sort of about 6 inches by four. There she is, flanked by a two-year-old and a four-year-old, my half-sister and my half-brother. What is really striking is the 24-year-old woman has a look to the camera that is so direct, sort of a really knowing gaze, completely confident. She's incredibly pretty, dressed almost, you wouldn't be able to place it in time, kind of loose cotton blouse, a bit of very ordinary little chain, but a fine link chain around her neck with something there you can't tell in the photograph, maybe a sort of imitation, probably glass, not a precious stone. What's very striking is this is a woman in control and confident. And the thing is, I never met that woman. Mm. When she gave away that baby, that woman disappeared. And I think more important than the shadow that runs through Roland's life is the shadow that ran through her life. And I understood things in retrospect because she became a rather hunched, bowed, apologetic, timorous person who could not withstand my father's rather domineering nature. And then, 60 years later, that baby got in touch with the Salvation Army and traced us, and I met him in a pub. Now, all of that, again, I wanted to bring to life on the page, especially a moment of total self-consciousness. I met him. He got there before me. I'm always late. I had no trouble picking him out. There was a guy who looked more or less like me, sitting with a glass of red wine at a table alone. He saw me and stood up. And as we walked towards each other, I thought, this is the strangest experience of my adult life so far. And when we met, one of us put out his hand to shake hands. So how do you greet? You know, it's not in Emily Post or anything. And the other went to embrace. I can no longer remember who did what, but we almost fell over in this kind of tangle of uncertainty. And it was that moment that I actually was going to put in the novel, and then I took it out because I realized I'd already written it in the introduction to my discovered brother's memoir. So I thought, well, I can't do this again. I'll just do it slightly differently. It's touched on, but not followed closely. And there is the person who was given away. His adopted father was a coalman, the man who just tipped coal down people's cellars. There was very little money in the house, extremely poor, working class family. They loved him very much, he said. He was without bitterness completely. He'd left school at 15, apprenticed to be a bricklayer. Our lives were so diverged, and yet I could easily see how I could have been him. I got sent to a rather experimental boarding school run by the state, cost nothing, and had a wonderful education and went to university. Mm. It was quite clear within 10 minutes of talking to him, this is a very intelligent man who also could have. So another theme which I pick up in this novel, and I know it's in certain of my other novels, just what a colossal role chance and contingency play in our lives. A biologist once said to me, reinforcing this point that I was making, if your parents had made love 10 seconds later, you wouldn't exist. Recombination, that extraordinary process of the merging of two sets of genes, is the shuffling of the pack, but it's a very, very large pack. And anyone who's had more than one child knows that you never know who you're going to get. And that's one of the marvelous things about it, and why I'm so interested in the ways in which all novelists are aware, since they try to control these plots, that these lives are... Well, anyone who's read professional philosophy knows that there hardly exists an argument for free will. We don't choose our genes, we don't choose our parents, we don't choose our environment. We certainly don't choose that moment of recombination. And yet the notion of agency and free will is one of the most important morally... the illusion of it is vital. Without it, without that fiction, the criminal justice system would just collapse. Because, as you say, he had no free will, my lord, Your Honour. he had to chop him to bits, but, you know... And, in fact, you do get that in court.
Yeah.
He had a tough childhood... argument, but what you ask me what I sort of discovered, but looking at this photograph was a revelation. I never would have reached for it otherwise. So writing about the disappearance of that woman and the mother that I had, who was so timorous, so shy, so crushed. Again, and this is really something how you might read in a Thomas Hardy novel, the first thing my new brother did was to go and see our mother. But she had lost her mind. And had he come just a year earlier, mm-hmm. he could have delivered her from and reconciled her to a sorrow that she'd carried with her all her life. So I wanted to get that. You know, what he had all the information he needed at the age of 20. He went and researched it all to find out his real parents. If he'd taken the extra step then, it would have changed everything too. Mm. But he also thought, well, they haven't been to check on me, so why should I? So I'm just going to get on with my life, quite reasonably, and left it another 40 years.
We're going to open it up for questions, and I will just ask one last question of my own as you prepare your questions, and it'll be a facetious one. But not about the Queen. Now you've written... I mean, I've been reading your novels for as long as you've been writing them. And I consider myself a great fan of your work. And I think, your best ever book. I found it a deeply moving book, partly just because of the scope of that life from beginning to end. Now you've written this kind of humanist, slightly... baggy, if I can use that word in a positive way.
Baggy meaning highly structured.
No, baggy meaning like pants.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, baggy meaning highly structured. Are you going to go back to writing little thin ones now?
Well, let's just deal with this little thin one thing. I mean, apart from Atonement, Enduring Love, Solar, Saturday, Machines Like Me, Sweet Tooth are all...
We can all name them.
Over, wait for it, they're all over 115,000 words. In other words, they are full-length, middle-sized novels. And they outnumber the thin ones, actually.
But they go so quickly, one enjoys them so much. They seem thin.
You can't get out of it like that. You can't get out of it like that.
Okay.
My novels are rather thin, I know.
There's a question.
I'd like to ask you a question about your wife. If I remember, years ago I read that when you were finishing Atonement, you were working very hard on the last chapter, or perhaps only the finale, and you weren't sure that you had it right. And when you read it to your wife, the fact that she began to weep convinced you that you had it right. And did I remember that right? And secondly, is she still helping you, and did she help you with lessons?
Yes, I mean, she doesn't always weep. but in fact, she's often much more kind of pointed. The story... is true in essence, that the details are wrong. We're walking in a wood just outside Oxford, and I recounted to her the last section. Also, what was not right about that was also I knew that I'd reached the end, and I wasn't asking her. I was just, this is what I've been doing. I was telling her. And when she... burst into tears, I thought, great. I was very lucky. I have to applaud myself on my foresight and wisdom in choice of wife. Because not only is she very lovely, but she has worked on just about every major British newspaper. She founded the Guardian Review when it was a 40-page weekly, long gone now. She worked 16 years in the Financial Times. She ran the FT Weekend for a long time. She worked on the Foreign Desk. She worked for the Sunday Times and the Times, Evening Standard. She was the drama critic. So she has a vast amount of editorial experience. She's very good at the big picture. So that was very clever of me. And she's also now a novelist, a very accomplished novelist. And so we do read to each other a lot because, you know, we go our separate ways during the day for in the same house, ignore each other all day. But often in holiday times, vacations, we go away we read to each other then, catching up with what we've been doing in private. Reading to people, though, is a bit deceptive because tones of voice and slowing and speeding up, I mean, you're doing things that the reader can't find on the page, and things often sound a bit better read to, which is why, of course, we all love to do it. But yes, I don't even know when we read to each other what, I mean, we don't, it just becomes a launch pad for discussing the whole thing, not one's not in that tender state of a first draft, wanting too much criticism or even encouragement. Just want to talk about it. No one's ever asked me that question before.
There's somebody halfway back or two-thirds of the way back.
If I heard you, you referred earlier to a free and direct style of
free and
writing.
Direct style.
I wonder if you could say more what that means and if that's what you aspire to.
Oh, it's one of the great inventions. The British tend to name Jane Austen as the one to first use it in an extended way. The French name Flaubert, especially in Madame Bovary. So it's a way of... It's always in the third person, and it's often a way of colouring the world with the emotions of that person without saying he thought or he said. So it's a way of having the freedom of the subjective access of the first person and yet at the same time being able to sometimes pull away and write objectively. So I might say, he set off that February to a nearby village. God, it was cold. Now, who's saying that? And that's not speech marks. And yet we accept the language of that. Children know how to do it. I mean, children, it's in children's books, and they know exactly that this is the thought of a person, which you couldn't possibly have in the third person, really. And you don't have to say, he thought. And the exclamation mark, God, is his, not the narrator's, not the implied omniscient narrator's. I mean, not a beautiful example, sorry, but you put me on the spot with it. There's a marvelous scene in, among many, in Jane Austen's novel Mansfield Park, when Fanny Price is being comforted by a cousin, who, of course, she will one day marry. And there, there's a beautiful use of free and direct style. I once wrote a lecture about free and direct style. You can find it, actually, in Homer, hardly enough, but only a sentence. The idea, you can find it too in the pillow book of, what's her name? Do you know that? Zhengdu. It's a 7th century AD book of court life in Japan. And that has two or three instances. And you'll see it once or twice in Chaucer. But it's not till the novel begins to find its feet in the 18th and especially in the 19th century, that it then becomes almost just a lingua franca of fiction, brought to a head by James Joyce. The lovely opening of Portrait of the Artist. And the first sentence is something like, once upon a time there was a moo cow. This is in a third person, and we know it's a child. And then it says, when you wet the bed, first it's warm, then it's cold. Again, the perceptions of a child rendered in a child's language. And then you're pulling out to some more objective circumstances in Stephen's life. So it's so stitched in now to us, and it's a very complicated, much more complicated to describe than actually read. Mm. And a five-year-old, reading to a five-year-old, would have it. You know, Beatrix Potter has it by the dozen instances of free and direct style. So it's almost stitched into the to our what Steven Pinker would call our language instinct.
And one more question.
What storytellers do you revere?
Well, many. Lately, what have I been reading? Well, yeah, I can tell you what I've been reading lately. I tell you what, the best answer to this is to tell you a novel you should all read, that you will never read unless I told you to. It's by a young woman, Chinese writer. It's called Cocoon. Has anyone read it? No. And it's about the generation of Chinese millennials whose parents and grandparents suffered the Cultural Revolution, or actually were bullies in it, or were people who turned the other way and who won't speak about it. So the generation, this millennial generation, have very little sense of the past because of this silence about all the terrible acts of violence and persecution that happened in the Cultural Revolution in the early 70s, 1970s. And also they have no brothers or sisters, no uncles, and also China is going through this great upheaval of suddenly declaring that capitalism was somehow not at odds with communism, and people who were peasant, dirt poor are suddenly becoming very rich, and so quickly that they're rather unpleasant in the process. Anyway, it's called Cocoon, and there's a writer I revere, I have to say. I don't have any Chinese. I read it in translation. The translation is absolutely stunning. And it seemed to me a feat of true mastery to be able to pull together so much that was historical and political, but told all through personal lives. And her name is Zhang Yuaran. But anyway, you'll find it anywhere with the title Cocoon. So I revered her for that immense feat of fictional mastery. And it brings China so much closer to...
And we revere the novel writing of Ian McEwan. Will you please welcome a round of applause for Ian McEwan?
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.